Welcome to the weekly sermon podcast of Valley Grove Baptist Church. We are thankful you stopped by to hear from God's Word, to grow closer to Him, and to be inspired to reach your area of influence. If you've got your Bibles this morning, let's go ahead and find 1 Samuel 25. 1 Samuel 25. That's where we'll be looking at this morning. Today's text will take us away from the Saul and David feud, or really, which is one-sided, and was going to step away from that and look at David and a couple other Israelite characters and how their interaction plays out. And so we'll kind of take a step back from David and Saul and just focus on David and how he interacts with another set of circumstances. Last week, if you'll remember, we finished up chapter 24, where David is in En-Gedi, and Saul comes to kill him. Saul's trying to find him to kill him, and David is in the cave in En-Gedi, and Saul goes into the very cave that David is in to use the bathroom, and David's men want David to kill Saul like this is their golden opportunity, and David doesn't. Instead, he just cuts the corner of his robe, and the story ends with David coming out of the cave and Saul realizing that David was in the cave. A corner of his robe is missing because David's holding it up. And Saul goes away and says, "David, you're more righteous than I am. And when you become king, you know, may God bless you, and just don't kill all my people." And that's kind of how the story ends. David stays in En-Gedi, and Saul goes home. Well, the story today picks up, which is I don't know about you, but as I was reading chapter 25 and I read verse 1, I went, oh, right? Because verse 1 tells us that Samuel dies, the guy who the book is named after, who's done all of these things for Israel, for David, and for Saul, and he gets one verse. Like, no funeral procession, no all of Israel came, you know, like, it's like, and Samuel died, and all Israel mourned. And they buried him here, and everybody went home. It's like, I don't know, it just kind of leaves you a little like there should be more. He should at least get two verses, not just one. He gets one verse. But in reality, we've been seeing this progression away from Samuel and really Saul and toward David. And so the book is really becoming more David-centric the further we get along. Now, obviously, Saul is involved. You say, well, he was involved last week. Yes, but he's involved in the story because he's involved with David in the story, right? And so we'll see that today. Our story focuses on what David is doing, not what Saul is doing. So after verses 2 and 3, or after verse 1, verse 2 and 3, let's read those. We're not going to read the entire chapter this morning. We will read a few verses here and there, we'll kind of highlight the whole story, and let me encourage you to go back and read it. So let's read verses 2 and 3, because it kind of gets us going in the story, gives us some important information about the action that's going to take place in the story. And there was a man in Moen whose business was in Carmel. Now let me stop right there, okay? And let us get the geography down just for a moment. All right, so the end of verse 1 said that David, after he went to see Samuel in the funeral, he went to the desert of Paran, however you want to say it, Paran. And Paran is even further south than where David has been. David is like really in the desert now. Like he's way in the south end of Judah in the desert. There's a guy in Moen. Now that's where David was previously, which is just south of Jerusalem in that area. David was there a few chapters ago, okay? And his business is in Carmel, which is kind of, if we can, make sure I get my direct, I'm doing this backwards here for y'all. All right, so if Jerusalem is here, the wilderness of Moen is like right here. Carmel is a city, which is like right here, and Paran is down here. Does that make sense? So Paran is the further south, then Carmel, then Moen, however you want to say it, and then Jerusalem, okay? So there's a guy who has business in Carmel. Now, here's his business. The man was very rich. How rich, you say? He had 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats. Can we just insert disaster? Chaos, right? Is 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats. Yes, he is very rich. Now, what was he doing in Carmel? He was shearing his sheep. Let me just stop there and say, I would have loved to seen that. I mean, how long does it take and how many men and women do you have there to shear 3,000 sheep, right? That's a process. Can we just say that? All right, so they're in Carmel. So that's what they're doing. Now let's read verse 3. This is going to introduce us to two new people we haven't met. Now the name of the man was Nabal, and his name of his wife was Abigail. The woman was discerning and beautiful. That word discerning means intelligent. It's the same word that the authors of Samuel used about David earlier in the story. Okay? The man was, listen, harsh and badly behaved. In other words, he was ill-tempered and did not have righteous or good behavior. Right? We've got a few teachers in the room. He's your special friend that sits by you in your class, right? If that was your kid, I'm sorry. It's not because they loved him so much or her so much. It's because that special friend needed a little extra attention, okay? Right? Then the author gives us another little clue. He was a Calebite. Now, what is a Calebite? All right, real quickly. A Calebite is the descendants of, wait for it, Caleb. Good job. That goes all the way back to Joshua and Caleb when they entered the land. Remember, Joshua and Caleb were the only two of the generation of Moses that made it into the land of Israel, into the promised land. You remember that? And Caleb, at 80 years old, says to Joshua, go, let me have this mountain and we will take it. What mountain was that? Well, it was around the area of Bethlehem. Right? In fact, the Calebites were responsible for founding the city of Bethlehem. Who in our story is also from Bethlehem? Yes, Jesus is from Bethlehem. But in 1 Samuel, who is also from Bethlehem? Let's say it a little louder. David. So David and Nabal are relatives. Now, how far are they relatives? We don't know. But it is absolutely indicative that they are relatives in some way, shape, or form. They knew each other, knew of each other, and their families were probably closely linked together. Okay? That'll be critical for the story later. All right. So, now, verses 4 and following, 4 through 12, kind of get us to the problem in the story. Okay? So, here's what happens. David tells 10 of his young men, remember they're in Paran further south, and David hears that Nabal and all of his many sheep and sheep shearers and shepherds and all that, that they're shearing their sheep in Carmel. So he tells his 10 men, hey, go to Nabal, be very deferential, be very humble, be very gracious, but basically say this to him. Here's the words. Therefore, let my young men, these are David's words that his men are supposed to speak to Nabal. Therefore, let my young men find favor in your eyes, for we have come on a feast day. Please give whatever you have at hand to your servants and to your son David. Okay? So, as the story goes, the 10 men go. They're super nice. They're deferential. They're humble. They're gracious. And they say those exact words to Nabal. Now, let's stop for a second and ask this question. Is David asking for a handout? Is David panhandling, you know, like the people on the side of the road? On first glance, you may say, well, it kind of sounds like he is. But as you read the story, that's not what has happened. Okay? Another question. What was David doing before he became king? He was a shepherd. Very good. What does Nabal have a lot of? Sheep. And sheep need? Very good. All right, y'all are following along today. All right, so while Nabal and his shepherds and his 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats were in Maon, David and his men were there as well. They were there at the same time. David, being a shepherd, allowed him and his men to run security and help. I mean, you have 3,000 sheep, right? You need more help. And so they protected Nabal's investment of sheep and people while that during the wool growing season, such that, the text where the text says, such that Nabal and his men were lacking nothing. Okay? So David and his men ran protection, security, and help for the herds that made Nabal rich. And there was some agreement potentially they had worked out. So David is simply saying, hey, bud, you're reaping the harvest of your sheep. I would appreciate it if you would pay my men for their labor when they were helping you protect your sheep during the growing season. Reasonable ask, right? Reasonable, you know. David's not asking for the moon. He's just saying, hey, man, will you give my guys some food and whatever you have, right? So here's Nabal's response, though. Let's read it with me, and we'll put it on the screen. Let's read verse 10 and 11. 10 and 11. You ready? Listen to Nabal's response. And Nabal answered David's servants, who is David? Who is this son of Jesse? He knows. They're from the same city. There are many servants these days who are breaking away from their masters. What has Nabal just insinuated about David? He is a rebel. He is a instigator of trouble for Saul. Okay? That's what he's insinuating. He's insinuating that David has broke away from his master Saul and he is causing problems. All right? Verse 11. Listen to the first persons in here. Shall I take my bread and my water and my meat that I have killed for my shears and give it to men who come from I don't know where? In other words, what is he saying? It's the same thing the three-year-old says, mine, and you ain't having it. So not only has he insulted David by asking, who is this guy? Your kinfolk, that's who he is. He's insulted David. Secondly, what else has he done? Called him a traitor and a rebel, revolutionary. And not only that, he's been inhospitable, ungracious, and downright rude and mean. Right? So, what happens next? Well, David's men don't get no food. No nothing, and they go back home, and they tell David what happened. And David has a very short response. David's words are, verse 13, every man strap on his sword. Every man strap on his sword. And so what David does is he takes, remember he's got 600 mighty men that are following him, he takes 400 of them. He leaves 200 with the baggage, or with their materials, potentially their families, and he takes 400, and all 400 and David are heading toward Nabal. They know where he's at. I mean, he's got 3,000 sheep to shear. He's going to be there a while. And so they're heading toward Nabal. And David is hot, right? Hence, every man strap on his sword, right? So, in the meantime, obviously, the conversation between Nabal and David's servants wasn't done in private. Well, at least we can say this. At least one of Nabal's servants hears Nabal's response to David and goes, oh no. Right? So listen, the servant, knowing Nabal and knowing Abigail, the servant, Nabal's servant, runs to Abigail to tell her what happened. Okay? He's, you know, you can put yourself in, like, I mean, he's probably, oh, you won't believe it. Oh, my God. Oh. And so he's telling the story of what happened. And there's two interesting statements that Nabal's servant makes to Abigail. The first one is, David's men were telling the truth. They helped us. I'm paraphrasing here. They were telling the truth. They helped us while we were all in Maon together. They helped us. They were not lying. All right. So he validates David's statement and David's request. Like, he was really there. They did what they said. They should be compensated. This is kind of the undertone. Now, here's the other thing. At the end of this servant's statement, he makes an amazing statement about Nabal. He says, let me see if I can find it here. It's in verse 17. The servant says, Now therefore know this and consider what you should do. For harm is discerned against our master and against all his house. Now listen to what he says. Now remember, this is Nabal's servant speaking to Abigail, Nabal's wife. Look at what he says on the end. And he is such a worthless man that one cannot speak to him. Okay? Now, real quick, Ren, go to verse 18. Then Abigail made haste. Notice what is not in between those two statements. What is missing? And Abigail said to the servant, "How dare you talk about my husband like that?" So listen. Think about it. How bad of a dude do you have to be for your servant to insult you to your wife and your wife to say nothing about it? Think about that. Because it's one thing for me to talk about my people. It's something else if you talk bad about my people, right? Because most of us would go, our feathers would get bristled and we kind of bow up and be like, you better watch it, right? So how bad does Nabal have to be for his own wife not to stick up for him to their servant? He got to be really bad. That's the most devastating indictment of Nabal's character right here, and it's what's not said, right? So what happens? Abigail, being discerning, i.e. intelligent, formulates a plan. And here's her plan. She gathers together a mountain of food. Now, this would not feed all 600 men and potentially their families for any real length of time, but it was a significant gesture. So what does Abigail gather? 200 loaves of bread, 2 skins of wine, 5 cooked sheep. So what's that, mutton at this point? Isn't that what you call it? Mutton? Mutton. Thank you. 35 quarts of parched grain, 100 raisin clusters, and 200 fig cakes. And she tells all of the servant to go gather all of that food and to go ahead of her, and that she's going to come after that on her own donkey. Okay? So she is going to break convention as a married woman and go find David and his men and talk to him by herself. She's like totally outside of the normal customary what should be going on in this culture, right? But she's going to send all of this food first, and then she's going to meet David. Well, she finds David before he gets to their camp where they're shearing sheep. It says that they're like in a pass, in a ravine, and so they're kind of like down, and David's like going to... The idea that you kind of get is David is using the terrain to sneak up on Nabal's camp. But in the ravine, the food and Abigail get to David before David gets to the camp. And so what happens is David says to Abigail, "In vain I watched Nabal's sheep." Basically, I wasted my time and the energy of my men on this worthless fellow, right? So Abigail gets off her donkey. She lays down before David. And then she gives David 6 things to think about, okay? In verses 23 through 31, she offers 6 ideas to David. Here they are. Number one, she says, do not regard Nabal. He is a fool. Now, here's the interesting part that you don't get in English. You know what Nabal actually means? Fool. So in other words, don't regard the fool. He's a fool. That's what his name means, right? In fact, if you read the whole story, it basically says something to the effect in the story, don't regard Nabal. He's a fool. He's living out his name. Right? She says, don't regard him. He's a fool. He's acting foolishly. Then listen to what she says. She says in verse 26, the Lord restrains you from blood guilt. In other words, may the Lord restrain you from blood guilt, from killing these people. In other words, your honor may be hurt. You may feel like you were slighted, and you may feel like your family disregarded you when you did. You didn't have. David was under no obligation to help him in the desert while the wool growing season, but he did, right? He may have even disregarded some agreement your shepherds and his shepherds had together, right? What she's saying is you really don't have cause for your action that you're headed down, right? So, don't regard Nabal, he's a fool. The Lord restrain you. Take these foods as a gift. In other words, take these as a present for our wrong. Now listen, it gets even better and even more important in verses 28 through 31. Because then she says, kind of paraphrasing again here, forgive us. Now let me ask you a question. Did Abigail do anything bad to David's servants? No. Who is the perpetrator of the wrong? Nabal. Very good. But what she does is she puts herself in between Nabal and David and says, forgive me. She had nothing wrong to do. She says, forgive us. Even though I didn't do anything wrong, forgive me. I'll be the bearer of all of the trespass against you. Right? So she says, forgive me, forgive us. Then look at what she says. And this is kind of the icing on the cake and the cherry on top in verse 29 and then 30 and 31. She says two things. She says, God is with you because you fight His battles. So in other words, she's saying, hey, we've all heard the stories. This is what's behind the text. We've all heard the stories. God is with you because you fight His battles. Now, what's behind that as well is the question of, is this really one of His battles you're about to fight? Is this really God's? That's what she's wanting him to think about. That's what she's wanting David to think about. David, you've been victorious because you fought His battles. Is this really one of them? You might, your ego might be hurt. You might be insulted. Hospitality and honor might not have been upkept, but is this really the Lord's battle? And then here's the, like, not the cherry on top, but like the whole jar of cherries on top is in verse 30 and 31. And here's what she says in essence. Don't do anything you regret. Let's read those. Ren, put those up there. Let's read verses 30 and 31. And when the Lord has done to my Lord according to all the good that has taken place concerning you and has appointed you prince over Israel. In other words, when you become king, my Lord shall have no cause for grief or pangs of conscience for having shed blood without cause for my Lord working salvation for himself. For my Lord working salvation himself. And when the Lord has dealt well with my Lord, then remember your servant. In other words, listen. In other words, David, we all know you're going to be king one day. And when you become king, you don't want to have any regrets for shedding blood without cause and trying to work out salvation for yourself. Right? All right, so six things. She says, don't regard Nabal, he's a fool. All right, number two. She says, The Lord restrain you from this blood guilt. This is probably not a good thing. Take these gifts as offering. Forgive me and us. God has been with you because you fought His battles. And don't do anything you regret when you become king.
Okay?
Now, what's David's response? David's response is he is stunned. He is overwhelmed by Abigail's great, wise, and intelligence in what is going on and getting him out of the anger-filled tirade that he was in and getting him to see a godly perspective on what action or reaction he should take, right? And so David turns around. He goes home. He doesn't pursue Nabal anymore, and he goes home. And so that's the main action of the story. Abigail saves Nabal and the rest of her people, right? And so David goes home. Well, that night, Abigail goes back to the camp, and she doesn't tell Nabal right then. She waits till the next morning. And here's how the story ends. The story ends very quickly, okay? So Nabal, when he hears what has gone on and how Abigail saved him and the rest of their people, here's what the text says. Nabal's heart died within him, and he became as stone. Now, commentators have a variety of medical explanations of what this is. Some people say it could have been a heart attack. Most people landed on he had a stroke, but the reality is we don't know. However, what is resolutely clear is what happens next, because the text is very specific. It says that, that 10 days later, the Lord struck Nabal and he died. Right? So what happens? God fought David's battle for him. Right? Now, the story ends. David hears news that Nabal has died. He's like, ooh, I remember Abigail. She was beautiful and discerning. And so he sends messengers really quick and asks Abigail to marry him. She obliges. I love the part. She quickly got on her donkey and rode to meet David. Right? So obviously David was an upgrade from Nabal, right? So the story ends with David marrying Abigail, and then verse 43, it tells us that David took another wife as well, or he had another wife named Ahinoam of Jezreel, and that Saul had taken David's first wife, and because David had run away, he had married her off to some other guy, right? So listen, just little insert, okay? Because we're here. I don't want to spend a long time on it. Now, how many wives has David had at this point? Three. Currently he has how many? Two. Okay, so real quick. Just because something is in the narrative does not mean it is normal or prescriptive. So guys, does this mean we get to marry two wives? No. It is just at the same time, right? Because that's like David's going on here. He has two wives at the same time. Okay? Just because it's in the story doesn't mean that is normal, prescriptive way we should go, right? It is just narrating what happened in the story. Okay? Don't get confused. We good? And all of us are saying, ah. Right. All right. So that's the story. Abigail saves her people. David turns around. And so really the story is more about who? It's more about Abigail than it is about David, right? She saves her people. And so when we come to look at this story, I don't think we can walk away and we ask, hey, what's the main idea of the story? Well, I got two. There's probably a lot more than that. I got two. We're going to talk about one briefly. And men, this in a minute, you need to respond correctly, okay? Or else it'll be a long ride home. Okay, I'm throwing you a soft toss, okay? There's two. We're going to focus on the second one. But you cannot talk about the story without realizing one of the main ideas of the story is a godly, wise wife is a treasure. No, Miss Jackie. God, you missed it. I gave it to you. I put it on the platter. All right, let's try that again. Yes, Miss Jackie, but you're not supposed to be the one that's supposed to respond. All right, let's try this again. Guys, this is your moment. A godly, wise wife is a treasure. There we go. Good job. Now, y'all can talk later about why you didn't get it the first time. All right, there we go. All right, but let's be real. She saves her whole family and all of their servants, right? She is a treasure. Like, she, in wisdom and intelligence, figures out what's going on and then comes up with a solution on how to remedy that situation and does it effectively. Even to the point of pointing out David of, hey, bud, you don't just need to look at this right here. You need to see the bigger picture. She puts things in perspective for David long term, right? A godly, righteous wife is a treasure. Thank you. All right, somebody don't want to get in trouble on the way home, right? Building up brownie points. There we go. All right, so here's the other thing, and this one does apply to all of us, and this is where I want to spend the time today because it applies to everybody. Whenever we take matters into our own hands, we often don't see all the consequences, right? Whenever we take matters into our own hands, we often don't see all the consequences, right? What happened with David? David was not worried about when he became king. He was not worried about what was going to happen next week. What was he worried about? Nabal. And getting revenge. And avenging the slight and the dishonor that he perceived that he had incurred. And so David was about to kill them all. Right? And so he lacked the ability to see what was going on long term, and he only wanted to deal with his emotion and feeling in that moment. And so taking matters into his own hands caused him not to be able to see the potential consequences down the road. Now, as I was typing this up, I had a question, okay? And this question will lead us and we'll kind of land the plane with the answer to this question. My question was, okay, totally get that. Taking matters into our own hands often leads to consequences we can't see. But then here was my question, okay? How do we know the difference between taking matters in our own hands and just hard work or due diligence? For example, I told you all this. If you weren't here, here you go. We're attempting to sell our house and move to another house in Upson County. That's kind of our goal, okay? So whenever you sell or buy, whenever you buy a house, so when we bought our house that we currently live in, after you kind of negotiate a price, there's a period called due diligence, right? Because Georgia is a buyer beware state, okay? Which means it's on the buyer's responsibility to get the house appraised and to do an inspection, right? That's kind of the process, right? It's called due diligence. Why? Because it is your responsibility to do some work to figure out if there's anything wrong with the house, right? That's a good thing. For example, let me give you another example. Back last year, the boys were doing things that boys do. They were in the yard with hatchets, right? Cutting trees and branches and all of that. And we had three pine trees in our yard. And they were like beating on the bark of one of them and kind of created this cavity in it. And weeks after that, I went over there because I looked at that tree and I was like, something's wrong with that tree. And I went over there to look at it, and they had peeled the bark away so that you could see that the base of the tree had started to rot out. And I took my pocket knife and went, let's see about this. And I started digging around, and my pocket knife went, whoop. And so they had peeled off probably about this much, but you could stick a pocket knife like as far as the blade would go in, which meant like half of the back of the tree was dead. Now, is it taking matters into my own hand to immediately call our tree guy and go, hey, bud, I need you to cut this down? Or is that due diligence, hard work, and wise? Because you could have said, I'm going to let the Lord take care of this and let the Lord's wind blow it wherever He sees fit. The problem is, the wind might blow it on their side of the house. Right? So what do we do? We got the sucker cut down. Right? So what's the line between taking matters in our own hands and due diligence and hard work? So I thought about this this week. I thought about it for a while this week. Because clearly, what Abigail was trying to get David not to do was take matters into his own hands and work out his own salvation for me, and instead trust in the Lord, right? That's clearly what she's trying to get him to do. So for us, what does that look like? Well, here's where I landed. Because I don't think this text allows us to make broad, sweeping statements about all of the instances of hard work and due diligence versus taking matters into your own hands, right? I don't think this text allows us to make one pithy preacher statement that will cover every situation that you might run into, right? So we're not going to do that today. The text does allow us to refine our statement just a little bit more in one specific area that we all face, okay? Now, let me ask you a question. What was David's emotion that he was feeling when he heard the news in Paran, and when he was riding to meet Abigail? What was his emotion? Anger, rage, fury, whatever. Yes, exactly, right? We know, and I'm going to give it to you because I thought it was hilarious, because sometimes the English kind of blunts or softens the actual, what the person is actually saying. So in verse 34, Ren, pull up verse 34 for us. Okay, so sorry, ladies, I'm just going to apologize for this for a minute, okay? But I want to give you the full sense of what he is saying here. Now, this is after he's decided he's not going to kill them all, okay? See that last line? Had you not come to meet me, truly by morning there had not been left to Nabal so much as one male. Here's what he really said. Hey, if you hadn't been, nobody who pees on the wall would have been left. He's mad, still mad. So what does that mean? Man, teenager, boy, infant, all of them dead. All of them. That was his emotion before he met Abigail, right? So what can we draw from that? We need to especially be careful when we are angry and enraged and fury-filled that we do not take matters into our own hands. Because as you and I both know, whenever anger and rage and fury is in our brain, we only see this right here. We do not have the ability to see beyond the issue that is right in front of us. Do we? No. Thankfully, in this story, Abigail allows David to see godly perspective. Right? Godly perspective. And in those moments when you can feel the anger and, you know, you start getting red in this area and you get red in the face, you need to take a minute. I need to take a minute and pray for some godly perspective in that moment. Right? Now, sometimes that comes immediately from the Holy Spirit to you. Sometimes you have a trusted friend like Abigail who comes in and says, hey, bud, you need to think about this, right? And sometimes it works in other ways. But in those moments, I can't tell you tomorrow what's going to be the difference between taking matters in your own hands and just hard work and due diligence. But I can tell you, based off this story, when you and I are angry, we really need to be careful, because we often allow our emotion to not to hinder our vision so that we only see rocks that run in front of us, and we lose perspective. And so we need to stop, pray, and ask God for godly perspective. All right? So, hey, look, I don't know what the odds are of you and I being angry this week. Probably pretty good, right? Some of you may be angry on your drive to work in the morning. Or for you teachers, by those special friends in your class. Or by those coworkers that you really love, right? The reality is, whatever we face this week, we need to shoot for godly perspective and not allowing our emotions, especially anger, to cause us to make rash decisions and take matters into our own hands.
Thanks for listening. For more information about Valley Grove, visit our Facebook page or website, valleygrovechurch.org.